Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, in response to an atheist who asked him, for what purpose did he create humanity if he had no need for them and neither was he compelled to create them, and nor would it be proper for him to create us in vain? He replied, he created them to reveal to them his wisdom, to execute his knowledge, and to carry out his plan. And Imam Sadiq alayhi salam also said, regarding the verse, but they continue to differ, except those on whom your Lord has mercy. And that is why he created them. The Imam said, he created them so that they may perform that which will render them deserving of the mercy of Allah, so that he may confer his mercy upon them. Thank you for joining us here on Hadith of the Day. We were looking at the reason for man's creation in the words of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Dr. Shiraz Hussain Agha for the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Now, the situation of Palestinians would be much different today if Islamic countries had united and fought against the establishment of the Zionist entity from the very beginning. This is according to the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Ali Sayyid Ali Khamenei, during his speech commemorating the day when Prophet Muhammad became a prophet. In his address to Iranian officials as well as Islamic leaders from other countries, he said that enemies resorting to Iranophobia is because of Iran's outward support for the Palestinians. And the leader said Tehran will continue to support Palestine in any way possible and said that all Islamic countries have a responsibility to condemn Israeli atrocities and to be united with each other. Well, we're going to talk more about this situation overall dealing with the Palestinians. And first, I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Elijah McNear, journalist and political analyst out of Brussels. And Fra Hughes, journalist, author, and activist out of Belfast. Thank you both for being with us. Let's start this off in Brussels. Tell me your overall perspective. I mean, when Ayatollah Khamenei used this occasion to mark the importance of the Palestinian cause for the Muslim world, your overall perspective on and why that was chosen and significance of it.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming.
The point of the Palestinian cause, it is the forgotten cause, because most the Arab nations are normalizing with Israel and the international community, including the Western community, is no longer advertising for the right cause of the Palestinians to return to their land and have their own state. So it is very important to always bring out the Palestinian cause because it represents the injustice that a large number of the population, the people of Palestine, are suffering. And because the West seems to be, claimed to be, very sensitive to human rights, and when we see nothing is happening, then we see other countries like in Iran, in Lebanon, in Syria, in Iraq, in Yemen, and a few other countries who are really concerned about the Palestinian cause and support the Palestinian cause. We see how the injustice is hitting the Palestinian cause in a place where they have absolutely no right. It is the only place in the world where Israel maintained a prison for the bodies, 375 bodies maintained by Israel. In the yearly annual report that I've seen only a week ago, when the Josep Borrell, the vice president of the EU Commission, acknowledged that there were 150 Palestinians, of which 33 children were killed last year, the report never mentioned anything about it. The UN condemned it. The US condemned the Israeli building of settlement, yet the settlements are built since 1948. There is no accountability whatsoever to the Israelis. This is why someone needs to remind the world about the right cause of the Palestinian, keep it in alive in the memory, particularly when we see the youth in Palestine are not forgetting and are claiming their territory back.
Well, Frank Hughes, you know, Iran has never hidden its support for the Palestinian and has paid a big price because of its support for the Palestinian cause. I mean, your overall analysis as a journalist of why do you think that Tehran has been so insistent and consistent with its support on Palestine since the beginning of the revolution, really, in 1979?
Hello, everyone. I think what we're maybe witnessing in Iran, that was a people's-led revolution, so we can assume that some of the policies that were absorbed into the Islamic Republic of Iran, not necessarily into the constitution, but into the fiber of society, into the body politics of what's happening on the ground, I think Iran is a bulwark against Zionism. If we look at Syria, I believe the main reason why Syria was attacked is because it is also a bulwark against Zionism, aggression and expansionism in West Asia. I think they were going for the domino effect of first we create ISIS, Daesh will destroy Syria, and then we'll either send in that army of mercenaries, murderers, and bloodthirsty psychopaths either into the Caucasus or against Iran. So Iran has the moral high ground. The Iranian government, the people of the world, actually, I believe, the majority of the people of the world support the Palestinian people in their call for self-determination and sovereignty. But it is the Zionist-supporting, Zionist-leaning governments of these countries that refuse to acknowledge the plight and the suffering and the oppression of the Palestinian people under the apartheid Israeli military occupation. So people support Palestine, governments support Tel Aviv and Zionism. But I think the one place where you find, it's not just the one place, one of the few places that you find the people and the government are walking in tandem on Palestine is Iran, is Yemen, it would have been Libya, it is Syria, it might have been Iraq, although more and more the Iraqi government seems to be standing up for Palestinian rights. And the crocodile tears and the hypocritical hand-wringing of the West about the continuing building of the illegal settlements, the continuing massacre of unarmed civilians in Palestine, in the occupied West Bank, by the Israeli forces, just shows that the West has fallen into a morass of immorality and corrupt politics, and one of the few beacons of political morality, I believe, in the world is in West Asia, and it is Iran, and it is Syria, and it is the likes of Cuba and Venezuela and Nicaragua, governments and Yemen, governments where people stand up, where the governments stand up for their people. And that is the way politics should be. And Iran should have everyone's support as it stands firmly against Zionist aggression.
Okay, well, Elijah, how much do you think that Tehran's support for Palestinian has led to this Iran phobia or anti-Iran sentiments that we see?
This is one of the elements that the West uses to attack Iran, because it is a question of ideology for Iran to support Palestine and the Palestinians. It is also part of the Iranian constitution to support the oppressed people around the world. So anything that Iran is doing is criticized and the country is demonized because Iran, first, is not submitted to the West. Secondly, it is claiming the right of the Palestinian, which is their legitimate right. And this is for the West. They see it as a danger to Israel expansion and existence. And Israel screams very loud by saying Iran wants to get rid of us, not acknowledging that they are really stealing the rights of the Palestinian, constructing settlement, misbehaving with the Palestinian, committing crime against humanity, against the UN Charter. So because of these elements, the behavior of Iran is called malign because it doesn't fit with the Western mentality, it doesn't fit with the Western objectives. On the contrary, it contradicts it because Iran is supporting the Palestinian and supporting the Palestinian like the Palestinian told us many times publicly, there are no limits and no conditions for what Iran is doing to the Palestinian, which means for the first time we see a genuine relationship where a country is not imposing its demand or its condition or its politics on another country or other people, the population, particularly in Gaza and the West Bank, without demanding anything in exchange. So the only objective is to free Palestine, and this is something that the West can't afford because there's nothing is given for free. And that's why the model that Iran is offering is extremely dangerous for the West.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
We saw during the recent World Cup how many Muslims sympathize with the Palestinian cause. However, most of their governments have been bullied or bought off basically into accepting Israel or turning a blind eye to the atrocities. Do you think that we're in the process of seeing a growing schism or separation between these Muslim nations and these rulers who have submitted to the Zionists, or your assessment of this whole situation?
I think there has always been that disconnect. I mean, I did mention earlier that I feel the people of the world as such support the Palestinians as an oppressed people who deserve the right to self-determination, yet it is the governments who support the Zionist apartheid state. It's exactly the same in West Asia. A lot of those, the Gulf states, Saudi Arabia, if we go back to the Sykes-Picot Agreement and the redrawing of the borders in what they call the Middle East, I mean, all the problems created today stem from them. A lot of those countries, the Gulf monarchies, have all, I mean, they send their soldiers and their generals to Sandhurst to be trained. They send their children to Oxford to be educated. They are all Anglophiles, and they see, this is the leaders of many of these countries, see more in common with the Western values of the likes of the United Kingdom and more and more and more with Israel than they do with the kind of Muslim ummah that's spread throughout the region and across the world. I think there are 2 billion, would there be 2 billion Muslims in the world? That's an awful lot of people who support the Palestinians. And I think it's important that if we look at the fact that a lot of these places like Saudi Arabia, they're not democracies. You can't vote in the government. You can't vote out bad policies. You have to put up with the dictatorship of the monarchy. I think what we saw in Morocco, and indeed I was in Marrakesh on holiday during the World Cup, and I saw people come out with the Moroccan flags during Morocco's games that they played during the World Cup, and I saw people with the Palestinian flags celebrating too. So, you know, basically until they get rid of the dictators in West Asia, we will continue to have the schism between the people and the governments. And the problem is the people are unarmed and the governments are armed, and a lot of them will not hesitate to bring the troops out onto the street to repress any dissent within the nation. And we've seen people go to jail for 10, 20, 30 years for putting up a tweet about the about Mohammed bin Salman as the Saudi Arabian leader. People going to jail for a tweet. So while there is corruption and while these corrupt leaders move closer and closer to the other corrupt leaders like Netanyahu within the region, I see no real opportunities other than the axis of resistance to stand against Zionism and to stand up for Palestinian rights under international law.
Well, Elijah, we seem to be unfortunately witnessing a record year of Israeli atrocities against Palestinians in the occupied territory. Israel has also just approved 9 more settlements, which are all illegal under international law. Do you think this scenario would be the same if Muslim countries were united in standing up against the Israeli regime? And how likely, in your perspective, do you see this happening anytime soon?
It's very unlikely for the Arab countries and the Muslim countries to stop their contact and normalization with Israel, because they have chosen a path that is, as your guest rightly said, there's a huge gap between the population and the leaders. So the leaders are taking unpopular decision, and we've seen the reaction of the population. Therefore, as long as these leaders are not in connection with the people, they will insist on their position because they are more or less intimidated by the U.S. bullying. And the U.S. is the bully of the world, imposing its will on all the countries. Otherwise, they will wage war or impose sanctions to cripple the population and turn the population unhappy against their rulers. This is why it is very unlikely for these countries to stop the relationship with Israel and to impose on the Israelis to respect the right of the Palestinians. Moreover, on the other hand, I think that what is happening today is not negative, is not all bad. They're having a very extreme right-wing government in Israel and having extreme measures by the Israelis is increasing the resistance, is making the voice louder among the Palestinians, making them more united. New groups are coming out. Youngsters between the age of 20 and 25 are responding to the Israeli aggression. They're rejecting it, including in the West Bank, those who were given Israeli identity, those who never known the PLO or the Democratic Palestinian Group or all the other different factions who started fighting the armed war against the Israelis in the 70s and in the 80s and in the 90s. So we are seeing a new generation, thanks to the behavior of the Arabs who tend to separate themselves from the Israeli cause, thanks to the radical behavior of the Israeli responsible, thanks to the extreme measures that the Israelis are pushing the Palestinians to the extreme, then there will be a reaction. And perhaps this reaction, if it increases and the Palestinians are united in Palestine, well, maybe the changes can happen. And that could influence on the Arab, like Qatar, who maintains some relationship with Israel. Nonetheless, it has a position where it is asking for the right of the Palestinians, which is better than nothing, although maintaining contact with the Israelis. On the other hand, we see the Saudis having good contact with the Israelis, but not declaring their normalization, and they have also meeting, etc., and without mentioning the Emirates, Bahrain, and other countries. So all this behavior of the Arab leaders is, in the eyes of the population, is shameful. In the eyes of the Palestinians, well, they know what they, we know what they think, but they voice it because they don't want to stop any possible support to the Palestinian population that is under the Israeli threat.
Right. Well, back to Belfast. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and other Israeli leaders have said that Iran is Israel's main enemy. The significance of that, and why do you think that they continue to say that?
I'd say their main enemy for the Israelis is the people they're murdering on the West Bank and the people they have under an inhuman, unacceptable, illegal siege in Gaza. They will claim that Iran is their number one enemy because if you are Israeli, if you are the prime minister of that country, if you are a right-wing, right-leaning, fascist-thinking thug in the government in Israel, you're going to look around and say, who are our friends and who doesn't like us? And I believe Syria was attacked because it stands for Palestine. I believe Iran will constantly be under threat. We have heard recently of the American administration taking the MEK off the terrorist watch list, which implies that the CIA are potentially going to start arming them, which is where I would see that leading to. So Israel, as an apartheid Zionist state, sees Iran as the leader of the axis of resistance against Zionist apartheid expansionism in West Asia. It sees Iran as helping the people of Lebanon when they try to give them fuel, of helping the people of Gaza to break the siege, of standing side by side, shoulder to shoulder with the people of Syria in denying Daesh and Western hegemony the opportunity of destroying the Syrian Arab Republic. So you have a secular Arab Republic closely allied to a theocratic Shia Persian government. So what we have are they're not diametrically opposed, they're two separate systems that have come together in common humanity to help each other in the face of the regional aggressor, which is the Western-inspired colony of Israel.
Well, what about that, Elijah? You just heard what Frost said, and I just want to pick up on that because he talked about the type of government that Iran has as opposed to Syria. And other, I mean, the main thing that the Western countries a lot of times and the Israelis talk about is Iran and sectarianism. And, of course, it's always trying to pit the Persians against the Arabs or the Turks. And isn't the situation actually what is happening with the Islamic Republic's support of the Palestinian cause actually an answer to all of that, that it has nothing to do with being a Shia or being a Persian or not being an Arab, but actually the resistance and being against oppression is actually key for Tehran over anything else?
This is a very good question. People don't read the Iranian constitution that forces Iran to support the oppressed people around the globe. And if we see the behavior of Iran supporting the Palestinians, who are majority Sunnis, supporting the Lebanese, Shia and Sunni, supporting the Syrian, who are majority Sunni, going to Iraq, and the first Iranian plane landed in Erbil in Kurdistan against ISIS, and not only in the Shia area, it has landed in Kurdistan. And Iran going to Venezuela, supporting the Venezuelan population that is oppressed by the Americans for so many years, it showed that Iran has a certain ideology that, notwithstanding all the pressure and all the sanctions, is really abiding by its ideology and abiding by its code. and is really fulfilling this code, even if Iran is under harsh pressure, it is managing to create allies unconditionally. That is the key of success of Iran, and this is why Iran represents a serious danger to the West.
Okay.
It can't be accused of sectarianism because it's diversity of the support.
All right. I'd love to continue talking about this, but we're out of time. I appreciate both of you being with me. Elijah Magnier out of Brussels, Franck Hughes out of Belfast, both journalists. A pleasure talking to you. And with that, that brings us to the end of this Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll try to have a look at the commentary of chapter Shu'ara, the 26th chapter of the Holy Quran. Let's listen to 165th to 167th verses of this chapter, Surah Ash-Shu'ara.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
Ata'tuna adh-dhukrana minal 'alamin.
Do you approach males among the worlds?
وَتَذَرُونَ مَا خَلَقَ لَكُمْ رَبُّكُمْ مِنْ أَزْوَاجِكُمْ بَلْ أَنْتُمْ قَوْمٌ عَادُونَ.
And leave what your Lord has created for you as mates, but you are a people transgressing.
قَالُوا لَئِنْ لَمْ تَنْتَهِ يَا لُوطُ لَتَكُونَنَّ مِنَ الْمُخْرَجِينَ.
They said, if you do not desist, O Lot, you will surely be of those evicted.
أتأتون الذكران من العالمين وتذرون ما خلق ربكم من أزواجكم بل أنتم قوم عادون. قالوا لئن لم تنتهي يا لوط لتكونن من المخرجين. These verses start the main criticizing of Prophet Lut to his people. Of all the creatures in the world, do you come to the males? وَتَذَرُونَ مَا خَلَقَ رَبُّكُمْ مِنْ أَزْوَاجِكُمْ. You leave what your Lord has created for you of your wives? بَلْ أَنْتُمْ قَوْمٌ عَادُونَ. Nay, you are a people transgressing. قَالُوا لَئِنْ لَمْ تَنْتَهِيَا لُوطٌ لَتَكُونَنَّ مِنَ الْمُخْرَجِينَ. And they said, If you desist not, O Lut, you shall surely be of those who are expelled. Now, we said how hideous and indecent act this sodomy is. Now, Prophet Lut tells the people that this is not a natural need you are following. This is not a spiritual need. This is not a bodily need. This has caused you to commit that deviated action, but this is not a need. This is only disobedience. This is only transgression that has polluted you by such an indecency and shame. You have left pure and natural bounty of Allah, and you have polluted yourselves with this indecent action. So Prophet Lut, what he mainly does is that he implicitly tells them that their deed is like that man puts the good fruits aside and goes to fatal and polluted food. This is not a natural need. This is indecent. Then, in the next noble verse, Prophet Lut implies that you people, you are engaged with lust. And the Holy Quran says that the people of Lut had been engaged with lust, pride, and haughtiness instead of obeying this divine leader and following his advice eagerly and delivering themselves from that polluted pool. They, instead of listening to him, instead of obedience, they stood against him. The verse said, قَالُوا لَإِن لَمْ تَنْتَهِ يَا لُوطٌ لَتَكُونَنَّ مِنَ الْمُخْرَجِينَ. If you desist not, O Lut, you shall surely be of those who are expelled.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qum.
So this is what people of Lut answered him. They said, if you do not stop it, we will expel you. لَإِن لَمْ تَنْتَهِ يَا لُوت لَتَكُونَنَّ مِنَ الْمُخْرَجِينَ. Those people told Lut that his words caused their thoughts to be confused, he made their peace to be disordered, and they were not ready to listen to him. And if he continued this job of warning them, his least punishment would be being expelled from their land. In some other places, the Holy Quran says that they fulfilled this threat and they ordered that Lut's family to be expelled out of the city because they were clean and did not commit sins. The Holy Quran said, They said, "Expel them from your town. Verily, they are a people who seek to purify themselves." Now, the misguided and deviated people sometimes reach a point that having a piety and chastity in front of them is a fault among them. Impurity, immorality will be honor to them. This is the evil end of a society that goes hurriedly towards corruption. This is what the Holy Quran warns. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.ir. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me. Worry ends when faith begins.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puriza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Thursday, Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah warned the United States and its allies that its attempts to stir chaos in the country will not be fruitful.
I'll tell the U.S., if you create chaos in Lebanon, then you will witness chaos in the entire region. If you target our people with your conspiracies, then we will use our power and arms to make you feel pain, even if this means war against your beloved Israel.
The leader of the resistance group also said that the 2019 protests in Lebanon were merely part of a U.S. ploy, which took advantage of weaknesses in the country as part of a new strategy after the failure of direct military invasions.
Lebanon has, from the year 2019, been the target of a new U.S. plot. First, it's a plot to eradicate the achievements and the victories of the resistance and its martyrs. And second, it's a plot to take Lebanon back to being under the hegemony of the U.S., which wants to impose its conditions on the country's domestic affairs and its conditions on relations with the enemy.
Nasrallah, who addressed people during the memorial ceremony of three of Hezbollah's martyred leaders, also emphasized that supporters of the resistance Citizens Group, who are suffering from economic crisis, will continue to support the group. Observers believe that all stalemates in Lebanon, whether the inability to elect a president or lack of economic reforms, are all the result of a wave of subtle interference by the U.S.
The U.S. is pressurizing Lebanon economically to impose its conditions and bring to power a president who is loyal to Washington and is not friendly with the resistance, so that it can implement its policies by means of soft power. Having said that, it would not seem that the U.S. has launched a war on Lebanon or the resistance. While it would seem this is an internal Lebanese affair, this is where the threat lies in their plots.
Nasrallah also touched upon the issue of offshore oil and gas exploration, saying Hezbollah will hinder Israel's production of gas from oil fields should procrastination by the companies who have contracts with Lebanon continue.
After assassination of any prominent leader of Hezbollah, the resistance would go through a landmark transformation. Now, in light of what analysts see as a massive U.S. attempt to choke Lebanon politically and economically, the resistance progress is unhindered. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
A little crumbling space filled with dirt and garbage. Rohingya refugee camp on the outskirts of New Delhi is no more than an open prison for the members of the community who face constant threats and intimidation from law enforcement agencies. They say all their activities are being monitored and reported to the local police station on a daily basis. A member of the community is given that task, but that is not the only trouble.
My son was picked up by police along with his wife from outside our shanty 4 months ago. He did not commit any crime. He has been in a detention center for a long time now. I'm worried for him. The UN Refugee Agency says they are working on the case, but nothing has been done so far. He was working as a day laborer in nearby colonies. He did nothing wrong. I humbly urge for his release. We thank God that India gave us shelter, but there is constant fear of detention in the camp.
In recent weeks, the Delhi High Court ordered a joint inspection of the Rohingya Detention Center in New Delhi by officials of concerned agencies over the alleged lack of basic amenities. The court was hearing a plea of a female refugee who is facing bad health conditions due to the lack of basic facilities in the detention center.
My brother recently got married and he was detained just 3 days after his wedding along with his wife. Since then, he's in a detention center. My mother is blind and she cries every day for him. We have been living here for years and we are grateful to India for giving us refugees. I sell vegetables on the streets and similarly other men do menial work, but we are scared now since detention fear is looming across camps.
Most refugees here have heartbreaking tales of the past, and those memories of carnage and exodus are haunting them. Based on official estimates, India is home to some 40,000 Rohingya refugees, but independent reports put the figures at hundreds of thousands. Most of the refugees I spoke with feared that their identity would be disclosed, given the high risk of detention. Scores have also gone into hiding at undisclosed locations across India. They have a horrific tales of separation from their families amid a persistent deportation campaign and an intensified crackdown against the community. Munawar Zaman in the outskirts of New Delhi.
Heads of NGOs in Syria have gathered to loudly voice an urgent need for help. In Damascus, more than 550 NGOs read out a statement before media outlets calling on the U.S. to lift its unilateral economic sanctions on Syria, explaining the years-long siege deprived Syria from its basic needs and equipment needed to rescue those affected by the deadly earthquake.
Today, I apologize to the victims who we heard their voices under the rubble but could not help. Our volunteers were hearing them but couldn't save them because we do not have necessary equipment. 12 years of sanctions left us without required vehicles and rescue equipment. Many people died under the rubble because of those sanctions.
Speakers say the recent ease of U.S. sanctions on Syria to help humanitarian aid reach the country is not effective. That's because banks, companies, and governments around the world are still reluctant to engage with Syria, as they might face legal obstacles in the future. Western states claim that food and medicine is not included in their list of sanctions, but the reality is vastly different.
Sanctions have affected my life, my neighbors, and all Syrian people. We don't have fuel or electricity, and this has raised prices of everything like food and medicine. This is unbearable, especially after the earthquake.
We all here came to say lift economic sanctions. This country cannot stand any more suffering. Even before the earthquake, we were collapsing economically. Those sanctions are only affecting the ordinary people, not the government.
Here, rescue workers are in a battle against time. The death toll keeps rising, and those who could get away from the earthquake are now struggling to survive with a lack of food and shelter. Syrians say it's about time the U.S. and its Western allies end the economic siege that has caused enormous pain and suffering for innocent citizens. They ask for a just and fair world where humanity comes first before all political agendas. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
We're used to the revolving door of Westminster politics, with prime ministers coming and going at dizzying speed. North of the border, things have been much more stable for many years, until this week.
In my head and in my heart, I know that time is now, that it is right for me, for my party, and for the country. And so today I am announcing my intention to step down as First Minister and leader of my party.
Speculation is rife about why she quit, such as the impact of the pandemic and the UK's top court ruling last year against Scottish government's ability to hold a second independent referendum without approval from the British Parliament. But there's one reason that stands out the most.
Her undoing was brought about by the very controversial GRR bill, which would have given people the ability to change their gender after 3 months without a medical certificate. This outraged many feminist groups in Scotland, and it was passed with a big majority in the Scottish Parliament, but was immediately blocked by the Westminster Parliament.
Sturgeon's resignation has also raised the important question of what will happen to Scotland's independence aspirations in her absence from frontline politics. After all, she was the architect of the referendum in 2014 and has pushed for a second one since the first didn't get a majority vote.
The majority of Scots do want independence. This stepping down of the First Minister will be seen as a setback, but it's not a major setback.
With that in mind, a lot will depend on who emerges as the leader of Sturgeon's Scottish Nationalist Party. Some of the names who might throw their hats in the ring: John Swinney, Deputy First Minister; Hamza Youssef, Scottish Cabinet Secretary for Healthcare and Social Care; Kate Forbes, Cabinet Secretary for Finance and Economy; and Angus Robertson, Cabinet Secretary for the Constitution, External Affairs and Culture.
Successive Conservative governments here in London have said that the 2014 referendum was a once-in-a-generation decision and that it cannot be repeated anytime soon. In response, Nicola Sturgeon said she would turn the next Scottish elections into a de facto referendum to ramp up pressure on London to grant another vote. But without her in the driver's seat, it'll now be up to her successor to deliver what she promised. Said Porizup, London.
This is all they have to survive with for now. A little crumbling space filled with dirt and garbage. This Rohingya refugee camp on the outskirts of New Delhi is no more than an open prison for the members of the community, who face constant threats and intimidation from law enforcement agencies. They say all their activities are being monitored and reported to the local police station on a daily basis. A member of the community is given that task, but that is not the only trouble. This woman says her son has been held in a detention center for months despite having a UN refugee card. With eyes full of tears and a numb voice, she revealed her ordeal.
My son was picked up by police along with his wife from outside our shanty 4 months ago. He did not commit any crime. He has been in a detention center for a long time now. I'm worried for him. The UN Refugee Agency says they are working on the case, but nothing has been done so far. He was working as a day laborer in nearby colonies. He did nothing wrong. I humbly urge for his release. We thank God that India gave us shelter, but there is constant fear of detention in the camp.
In recent weeks, the Delhi High Court ordered a joint inspection of the Rohingya Detention Center in New Delhi by officials of concerned agencies over the alleged lack of basic amenities. The court was hearing a plea of a female refugee who is facing bad health conditions due to the lack of basic facilities in the detention center.
My brother recently got married and he was detained just 3 days after his wedding along with his wife. Since then, he's in a detention center. My mother is blind and she cries every day for him. We have been living here for years and we are grateful to India for giving us refugees. I sell vegetables on the streets and similarly other men do menial work, but we are scared now since detention fear is looming across camps.
Most refugees here have heartbreaking tales of the past, and those memories of carnage and exodus are haunting them. Based on official estimates, India is home to some 40,000 Rohingya refugees, but independent reports put the figures at hundreds of thousands. Most of the refugees I spoke with feared that their identity would be disclosed, given the high risk of detention. Scores have also gone into hiding at undisclosed locations across India. They have a horrific tales of separation from their families amid a persistent deportation campaign and an intensified crackdown against the community. Munawar Zaman, the outskirts of New Delhi.
Tehran has hosted the first disaster management conference titled Strong Iran. The three-day event has brought together different representatives and experts from various organizations which are responsible for managing natural disasters at the time of crisis. The event is aimed at training responsible organizations to have proper response to natural disasters. Meanwhile, Iran's interior minister addressing the event referred to the earthquakes in Iran, Turkey and Syria and said that the country should maintain its readiness more than ever before.
These events are a warning that we must maintain our preparation more than ever in the past, and dealing with natural disasters requires a modern and not a traditional approach, and the dimensions of these events must be controlled with the help of managerial, human, software and equipment skills.
Iran has been a very disaster-prone country throughout its history. Earthquakes, floods, droughts, inversion effects of air pollution in metropolitans have occurred many times, affected millions of people, and have claimed hundreds of thousands of lives during the past century. According to the World Risk Report, Iran is among the countries with high vulnerability in the world. More than 80,000 people have died during the past 30 years in Iran, directly by natural disasters.
The main objective of crisis management is to identify and prioritize crisis threats to formulate the best strategy for confronting the most immediate ones. Accordingly, holding such an event provides a good opportunity for officials and people to be prepared at the time of crisis. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
Lives have been saved in Turkey following recent earthquakes because the country had access to heavy lifting machinery. Experts say many lives were lost in Syria because sanctions prevented the country from having similar equipment. The catastrophe has just been debated in the European Parliament.
Following the disaster, I contacted one of the largest aid agencies in Syria. I've spoken to Italian agencies and other NGOs. They all told me that the EU sanctions present an obstacle to humanitarian work.
European Commission officials told legislators that just 9 of the EU's 27 member states have supplied Syria with support. 21 have scrambled to help Turkey.
The Commission also allocated an additional 3.5 million euros in emergency humanitarian funding to help our partners address urgent needs in Syria.
This 3.5 million euro for Syrians pales into insignificance when compared to the 67 billion euro spent by the EU on Ukraine during the past 11 months. Experts have been saying for years that the bloc lacks unity when it comes to Syria.
Countries are acting in their own way. There is no coordinated action. And this is one of the reasons that we're faced with this very big crisis, this mega crisis.
Efforts by Western nations to overthrow President Bashar al-Assad have failed. Critics say interventionism has brought misery to millions of innocent people in the country. Some lawmakers want the pressure to be paused.
In Syria, there are sanctions. We don't want to see more people die in the cold. They don't have medicines. We must put politics aside and human life first.
It's been announced the EU will host a donors summit next month to gather money for the earthquake-hit regions. Political commentators are claiming it's already obvious that the vast majority of the money raised will go to Turkey, not Syria. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
I am visiting a children's hospital in Kabul, which is said to be overwhelmed with malnourished kids. Every few hours, a sick child is brought into the malnourishment ward, while doctors and nurses are racing against time to save the youngest victims of Afghanistan's crisis.
Unfortunately, this year, undernourished cases, especially severe acute malnutrition, have significantly surged compared to last year. Constant hunger and poverty and differing diseases are to blame for this, which puts us in dire need of more supplies and medical aid.
As you know, Afghans are gripped with poverty and economic problems. As a result, we are overwhelmed with a huge number of malnutrition. We are running out of bed and sometimes we are forced to reject new entries. Besides, childhood wasting as well as child mortality have also soared.
The World Health Organization says in 2023, around 17,000 Afghan babies and mothers are expected to suffer from severe acute malnutrition, while over 2.3 million children may suffer from moderate acute malnutrition. The UN body adds that an estimated 28.3 million people, which comprises two-thirds of Afghanistan's population, need urgent relief assistance.
We are a family of 10. My husband is a shoemaker. This malnourished child of mine is 3 months old. Two of my children died as a result of wasting and stunting.
Afghan people's miseries are growing day by day. Unemployment, poverty, and famine have gripped the society, with poor and middle-class households being hit hard. Many have brought their malnourished kids here, and I think it is because they have no food in their houses. We are calling on the global community not to ignore Afghans amid political and economic crises.
Concerns are on the rise among Afghans over their isolation from the international community and major cuts in global aid following the Taliban's takeover and U.S. withdrawal from their country. Afghanistan has one of the highest rates of malnutrition in the world. Afghans are calling on the global community not to leave them alone amid poverty and hunger. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Hundreds of people attended a national conference in Gaza, which was organized by Palestinian resistance factions. The event aims to bolster the resistance in Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank. In recent weeks, extremist Israeli settlers and political figures backed by regime forces have been violating the sanctity of the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Al-Quds. Israeli forces have also killed and injured dozens of Palestinians in the occupied West Bank since the beginning of 2023. Speaking to Press TV, the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas said the resistance in Gaza is ready to support the resistance in Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank.
We will not leave the resistance in Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank alone, and we will back them with all the necessary means. The occupying regime will not be able to divide the Palestinian resistance arenas. Last night, we witnessed unity in Gaza, Nablus, and Al-Quds.
Occupied by Israeli regime forces more than 55 years ago, Al-Quds has been at the core of the Palestinian struggle for freedom.
Actually, Al-Quds is not just a word. It's something apart from our heart. So this conference asking and telling the world that this Israeli action against Al-Quds and West Bank must be stopped.
Palestinian resistance factions have expressed their unwavering support for Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. They also vowed to use all forms of resistance to liberate Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank.
We believe that the Israeli government, under the leading of Netanyahu and Smotrich and Ben-Gvir, going to raising up the aggressive against our people in West Bank, in Jerusalem, in Gaza also, maybe in other outside countries also. So we are going to resent the occupation by all kind of resistance.
Observers say the international community has failed to help Palestinians in Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank, while turning a blind eye to violations committed by the Israeli regime against them for decades. Palestinians say that they will continue their struggle against the Israeli regime until the liberation of Al-Quds and all of Palestine.